Hey Mets fans, welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. We are we're back for a second week in a row. Last week, we spent a lot of time sort of discussing our personal feelings about the morality and ethical nature of playing baseball in 2020. We are not going to get into another conversation like that today. So if that was a bit heavy, don't worry. We're not going to tread there. Although we do want to say that everything we say today is rooted in that still. We still very much feel that way. Not that we would change our minds, you know, a week out, but just feel we have to say that. So we're going to talk about sort of what baseball's going to look like this season and the proposed rule changes that are going through and what the rosters are going to look like and things like that. So where do you want to start, Chris? Should we start with the big one with the Universal DH?
Yeah, I think that's a good spot to start.
So I know that we are National League baseball guys and we've been bred to watch this brand of baseball. And I think for the most part, almost every National League fan I know is anti-DH. I certainly fall in that category. But how do you feel about this experiment of Universal DH for the 60-game season?
Well, I guess I was never going to be on board with the DH in the NL. There have been points, I would say for years I had said, if there's ever a DH in the National League, I'm out, I'm done, I'm not watching baseball anymore. That's not true, even with everything else that's going on. I did say there was one caveat that I was willing to cave when David Wright clearly could not play the field and hit on a daily basis. I was totally fine with making the exception if it meant David Wright could play baseball for longer. I get it. I mean, pitchers are coming into this with an abbreviated ramp up to start the season. I think pitcher injuries while hitting are overblown as a concern. I don't think they're that common. They've happened, but you know, it's not something that happens every week in National League Baseball. But if you want to say we've got all this strange stuff going on, not just in the real world, but in the game, I guess I'm fine with it. I don't love it. I'm never going to love not having pitchers hit. And, you know, I've had decades of American League baseball being one thing and National League baseball being another. And, you know, just not ready to give in on that.
See, what's interesting about that is I remember folks like my dad used to say that they remembered when all baseball was the same, and he was not for the DH, but he said that he missed the uniformity of baseball. So it's interesting that, you know, because I feel like you do. I like that there's two different brands of baseball and that you get to choose which one you prefer and or experience both of them, right? I like that variety, but I think that's likely a just a function of when we were born / started watching baseball. I think, you know, older fans probably think about it differently, and I think even younger fans maybe think about it differently. I don't know how people feel today. Like, I don't know how a new fan feels about baseball. You know, all I can do it is look at it through my, you know, approaching middle age vantage point. But
right.
I am not a fan of the Universal DH. I think for this season, I don't want to say there's good reason for it, because I really don't believe that. But I understand the concerns for this year that the real life human concerns that supersede my baseball concerns.
Yeah.
I understand them. I still think that it's not the only solution here and maybe shouldn't be treated as the only solution. But, you know, whatever. If the trade-off is that we actually get to watch baseball and that the baseball players are healthy and being taken care of, then I'm more or less okay with it for this season. We had a great piece on Amazing Avenue this week by our friend Vass, who talked about how the Mets sort of accidentally have the perfect team for the Universal DH this year. Yeah. There are just so many options, and you can rotate players in, or if they wanted to, they have probably four options who will be, I don't want to say as good as any DH in the American League, but we'll be pretty close, you know. So I think it might wind up being a good thing for the Mets, and I fear that it's going to be a good enough thing for baseball in general that people are going to be beating that drum even louder in the coming years.
Right.
Which is a bummer, but.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I guess if I'm going to say that in you know, the past, I would have made the exception for David Wright. If it was to stick around and Cespedes comes back and, you know, plays under these circumstances and is destroying baseballs like he used to do, then this winter I might say, you know what? Bring him back, keep him around. Clearly he's coming back from multiple leg issues, and there's no guarantee, but if he goes and shows that he's capable of anything close to what he has been as a Met, and I know 2015 was like the ultimate highlight reel of his time as a Met, but his, when healthy, his entire time as a Met has been excellent. So having that kind of guy around makes me a little more willing to sacrifice the principle of of a league that doesn't have a DH. But we'll see. I mean, that assumes multiple things.
It does.
One of which is that the Mets might be sold by the time of the off season, and, you know, might sign players.
Right.
Yeah, there. If Cespedes is not any more or less likable based on how healthy he is this year. It's just if he's healthy, add him to the list of likable players who, you know, you'd like to see kept on the team. And right. Marcus Stroman is, you know, he's been healthy. He's a guy who's going to be, you know, set for free agency. But the whole reality of everything is so strange. So I don't know. I don't know where we'll be. It is bizarre that we are recording this on July 1st. And usually by this time of year, we are talking about the offseason that's coming up. Because even if the Mets are going to finish strong and make the playoffs, usually around now, you're starting to think about next year already.
Yeah. That's a fair point.
In some way, shape, or form. I think on the site, we've had, you know, multiple pieces about major flaws on the roster that we've run in July or August. You know, looking ahead, hey, look, we're experiencing this thing right now. Maybe they should do something about that this winter. So,
yeah. I mean, I think that even beyond Cespedes, just looking at the way the Mets roster is constructed, you know, if you want to be optimistic and say that Robbie Cano can stick at DH, I mean, at second base for the time being, you know, Dominic Smith is a DH above everything else, essentially, because the Mets were never going to let him start at first base. So his best position for the Mets right now is a DH. I think J.D. Davis's best position right now for the Mets is a DH. I think that Wilson Ramos, in a lot of ways, best position right now is DH. So, you know, there are a lot of options for legitimately good DHs on the Mets, even beyond this season, even if that doesn't include Cespedes. That still doesn't make me want to necessarily get rid of my principles, as you said, and and want a DH. But I do think that it makes the idea a little bit more appealing for Mets fans when we just see just how many good options there are right now. Now, I wanted to ask you about the other big proposed rule change here, which is the start extra innings with a man on second. I hate this even more than the DH somehow.
Oh, yeah.
Do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that is at universal DH, or the addition of the DH to the NL. It's the same thing. Is still baseball. I think a few years ago I would hit myself for saying that, but it is still baseball. You know, you get into like that concept is just, it's so dumb. And you know, you listen to people who've seen it at the minor league level, it's not entertaining. You know, it makes for this boring setup of whether or not you intentionally walk the first batter. And then, you know, there's probably going to be a sacrifice bunt almost all the time. And then you're dealing with, okay, runner on third or runners on second and third, but in extra innings, you know, it's the first runner on base who really matters the most. That's what kills me, is that there are so many things that make baseball unique. Obviously, the biggest one is not take this object and try to get it past the other team into some receptacle, you know, right, whether it's a hoop, a net, an end zone, whatever, you know, so that obviously the basic definition of the game is unique. But I like that there's so many other things that make it unique. And just gifting somebody a runner on second, and it's, you know, the way it's going to play out is that the guy who made the last out starts on second base. Like, I feel like I've seen better ideas in beer league softball on how to finish a game. So, yeah, I hate it. I don't know. I constantly question why the people in charge of baseball seem to hate baseball so much.
Yes. I don't think anybody would sacrifice the, like, one of the things that really bugs me about the rule, like, that particularly bugs me, I should say, because lots of things bug me, but is this idea that, like, when you're watching a game and the game gets to extra innings, there is this palpable excitement when your team gets a runner on base because it gives you life. And that is, you know, I mean, look, a walk-off solo home run is lovely but rare. Oftentimes, you see a rally start, and the excitement that comes from a rally in extra innings is unrivaled by most regular season sports, if you ask me. And to basically start with that premise just seems so bananas. Just it takes away all the drama that leads up to that. I just cannot imagine being excited about that as a prospect. I can't. It literally makes me upset when I start to think about it. And I don't think that ultimately it's going to change that much, because was it 2012 or right around there where the Mets seemed to have every other game go into extras. There was one year. Maybe,
yeah,
not quite
something
a
like
ago,
that.
Where and I feel like the Mets got a man on base every single inning, and never scored. So I mm-hmm. don't even think this is necessarily going to do what it's supposed to be doing. Which I think, if you speak to most people who enjoy watching baseball, like, people love weird baseball. People right. love baseball after midnight when it gets weird. Like, yes, the play gets sloppy, and yes, it can be a slog, but ultimately it doesn't happen that frequently. And when it does happen, it can be really fun. So it just makes no sense to me that this was really the best idea they came up with.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, man. It's and I don't know statistically whether it's had any effect on how long minor league games go. But since both teams are starting each half of an extra inning with the same thing, on paper, you know, obviously it varies based on circumstance and how good the team is and all that, but by the rules, each team has an equal opportunity to score.
Right.
It's just the dumb one, you know? Yeah. So I guess saying, okay, you know, we know in the sport, and by no means am I defending this terrible idea. I'm just saying, I'm trying to think through how you end up there. We know that managers are not likely to use their best relief pitcher
in a tie game. Right.
Especially a tie game on the road. That's the cliche. It's dumb, but it's the way it is. So whoever came up with this idea a few years ago, and now obviously is being applied in these times, I guess thinks, okay, you know, force the issue, make a run score, make everybody use their best players, you know, let's get this over with kind of thing. But there's logically no reason that that makes the pandemic doesn't make that any smarter or any safer. You know, that you can't pass that off as saying, oh, okay. Even if we find that extra inning games end faster on average than they would have before, these guys are still going to be flying on planes together. You know, we can talk all we want about what they're going to do while they're on the field, but playing a few extra innings isn't going to make or break the effect of the pandemic on the athletes who are playing.
Nope.
At all. Like, the close quarters are going to be, even if everybody has their own hotel room when they're on the road, the close quarters will still exist on a plane, a bus, in the clubhouse, and I don't know. It's just dumb. The DH doesn't make me feel like I'm not watching the same sport, but extra inning games are going to just be. I will say the best part of this will be Gary, Keith, and Ron talking about how stupid it is every time it happens.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I am not a traditionalist or a conservative person in matters of real life, but baseball, not the bad parts of, like, don't change anything with baseball. The culture, players, celebrations, all that stuff, obviously, I'm on board. But the rules of the game, I'm fine with not changing any of them.
Yeah. Well, that sort of dovetails nicely into the three batter rule, which is equally, maybe not equally, it's frustrating. I think it's less frustrating than the batter than the runner on second base. Still frustrating, just less frustrating than that. Do you think that the three batter rule is going to fundamentally change as much as the commissioner's office believes it will change the game in terms of pace of play?
No, I don't think it's going to be a fundamental change. If anything, I think we're just going to end up seeing, and I know they tried building in some things with it to prevent this, but fake injuries happen in other sports. You know, who's to say how your arm feels or how your leg feels? Or, oh, my leg cramped up. And, you know, the trainer comes out and I throw a test pitch and I just go, no, I can't, you know?
Yep.
I feel like you open yourself up to that. And even if you say that guy is going to come out and, you know, can't pitch for a few days or whatever, I think you open yourself up to some stupidity, and I don't see the point. I know that people tend to some baseball fans tend to get into a little bit of a complaining mood when multiple changes, pitching changes happen mm-hmm. in the same inning. I don't know. It's just never been a thing that really bothered me. I mean, if it was about pace of play and not anything else, just make the pitching change be as short as it needs to be, not a commercial break.
Right. So I was talking with a Yankee fan friend of mine. Yes, I do. I do socialize with Yankee fans, of course. I said to him, like, I don't understand all this pace of play stuff because I want more baseball, not less baseball. And he said, well, I understand that, but pitching changes isn't more baseball. It's just a longer time you're sitting in front of the TV. And so I don't terribly disagree with that. I thought a much more reasonable change would be to limit the amount of pitching changes you can make in a regular season game with obvious exception for injuries. So if you said, you know, okay, in a 9-inning game, you can make 5 pitching changes. To me, that involves far more strategy than the 3-batter rule. Because if you're in the middle of a blowout, you're at that point probably more likely to bring in a mop-up guy for 3 or 4 innings, which will be faster than having a 3-batter rule I just feel like it's taking the weirder part of the pitching change out of it. Like, how can I say this? I guess I feel like the pitching change itself to me is a strategy I don't want to take out of the manager's hand too often, but I still think you can limit it in a way that isn't the 3-batter rule.
Right. Well, and the 3-batter rule does allow a manager, if he needs to get out of an inning, the ending an inning qualifies no matter what, right?
Right, yes.
So say a righty gets an out, gives up a single, gets an out, there's a lefty coming up, I can bring in my lefty, and he either has to get out of the inning face 3 batters.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, I don't like that leaves it open to kind of the way that lefty specialists are often used.
Right. It just means you have to live with the consequences if they're not successful.
Right. So, yeah, I don't know. It's
annoying, but it's not. I think of the things that will bug me this year, it'll probably bug me the least of the rule changes.
Right. Well, yeah, I definitely rank the extra inning bullshit as the worst.
Yes, agreed.
And then the DH after that. So yeah, I'd put it below both of those things for sure. But it's one of those things that I don't really know how much I'll hate it until we see it.
Right, right. Because aesthetically, I think we all like watching pitchers. We all wish starting pitchers would pitch more because we enjoy watching them pitch. So, like, the idea of having less pitching changes might lead to starters going longer, and that could be an aesthetically good thing for the game of baseball.
Yeah, that could be – I think that would be most applicable in a season where the world isn't on fire.
Right, yes.
There's 6 weeks of spring training, and everybody's ramped up, and everybody's good. So we have all this stuff that's like, oh, okay – you know, by the rules that are going to be used in, you know, in our heads, hey, Jacob DeGrom, Marcus Stroman, 7-8 innings every time, except they're not going to be, you know, I mean, I know they're great athletes. I am sure they're in shape, but they just have, it's just not the same. They have not been playing in games. So for, you know, a season that's going to be 8 weeks long or whatever, 2 or 3 weeks of it, pitchers aren't even going to be capable of going that deep into a game.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
The 3-batter rule, you know, the universal DH, there's a lot of incentive to not take your starting pitcher out of the game if he's pitching well. But, you know, maybe if there's still a season happening in August, that effect will be felt.
Right. Yeah. Which is a very big if, again.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk for a second about sort of roster construction. So our pal Jay Jaffe wrote a great piece for Fangraphs going through pretty much every iteration of the rosters right now and sort of what that means. And we'll simplify it a little bit here, but essentially, so because there is no minor league season, there is no like natural pool of talent to draw from if your team needs a player, whether it's for you know, to replace an injured player or because, you know, they're hitting the shit out of the ball in AAA, whatever the case may be. There isn't really a natural group of players because there aren't going to be minor league games. So there is this 60-person player pool that every team will be able to draw from. These players will be training at an alternate training site, which for the Mets will be, is it MCU Field now in Brooklyn?
Yeah, yeah, it's still that, MCU Park.
MCU Park, yeah. So they will be playing there and you know, doing intra-squad games and things like that and workouts. And for player, the 60-man player pool is made up of players in the 40-man roster who are likely to play this season. So that means that Noah Syndergaard does not have to be on that because he is not going to be playing this season. That means that you know, some of the Mets' younger prospects on the 40-man roster are not going to be found on that list because they, again, are unlikely to be playing this season. So it's made up of those players as well as anyone that the Mets have in their system that the Mets feel might have an impact this year. And so that right now looks a lot like the 40-man roster plus a couple of pitching prospects plus a bunch of the non-roster invitees that went to spring training, guys like Ryan Cordell, Jarrett Parker, Erasmo Ramirez, Eduardo Perez, and then a couple of folks the Mets signed this week, and we'll probably go through those signings, you know, in a few minutes. But overall, the sort of easiest way to think about it is that those the 60 players on that list at any given time are the players that a team can draw from. Now, if a player is on the 40-man roster and they are to be removed from that list, they have to be exposed to waivers before they can get back to the organization, but off of that list. If a player is not on the 40-man roster and is removed from the player pool, they are released. I have that correct, right, Chris?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty sure.
I believe the team can re-sign them, but they at least go through the process of being released first.
Yeah.
Players can be added or removed from that list throughout the season. So, you know, the Mets right now, I believe, have 51 players on their list, if I'm not mistaken, or somewhere.
Yeah, I think that was the latest.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's smart to leave those spots open until we're closer to opening day because there might be a pitching prospect who is looking great, or maybe Tim Tebow finally figured it out, right? Like, you know, you want to have the opportunity to add those players when it's closer to spring training, to closer to opening day, rather, because you don't want to have to pull somebody off that list and potentially lose them, whether through a waiver transaction or through just being released and going elsewhere. The system's a little confusing, but I actually think it's a relatively smart way to organize things. My question for you, Chris, is the Mets have got some flack from folks saying that it's wrong of them to not put their top prospects on that list because this is the only way those top prospects are going to get any sort of traditional development this season. With the lack of minor league season, a guy who would be in rookie ball, well, who knows what the way the minor leagues were going to be changed up this year anyway, but, you know, whoever's going to be in the lowest level of the minors, they are going to spend this entire year not playing professional baseball. And so the criticism is you should put, you know, four or five of your top prospects on that list so that they are still developing during the year. The argument against that is that this is such a weird year anyway. I don't know how much 8 weeks is really going to do for a player's development. So construct your roster in a way that's best helping the only team that's actually playing games this year, which is the Major League roster. So where do you fall on that debate?
Well, I don't have a passionate take either way. I guess if you're looking to make the Mets the most competitive team possible this year, then having, you know, a mix of basically guys who would be at AAA in a normal year, mm-hmm. Hanging around and ready to contribute to the Major League roster, that's probably the best way to go about it. But I understand the concept of wanting to balance out the short and long term of it. So, you know, it's a little weird to totally ignore it. And I guess at this point, we don't know for sure yet that the Mets have totally ignored it, but some of their best prospects are guys who would not have been knocking on the door of the major leagues this year.
Right.
You know, barring outstanding production. So, yeah, I don't know. Coming into this, you know, back when we were looking at previewing a baseball season in full, and I think in a short season, it's even magnified, the concept that the NL East was totally up for grabs. And yeah, in a short season, anything could happen. So, yeah, I don't know where to land on it. So long as this is happening, I think the major league team should try to win games.
Yeah, and I think it's this situation's exacerbated by where the Mets find themselves sort of as an organization right now. You know, if it was a case where they were, you know, the Tigers or the Marlins, where there really isn't a chance for them this season, then I completely understand this argument of, you know, you do not mess with the development of your future to mortgage your, you know, you don't mortgage your present on the future, right? Or however that's said. I am talking like a crazy person, and I've had a third of a beer tonight. But you understand what I'm saying? Like, you don't want to fuck with the future for a lost season, essentially, right? But the Mets, but the Mets find themselves in a place right now where they ended last year really strongly. They have the best pitcher in baseball. They have maybe the best power hitter in baseball. They have a potentially great bullpen. I know that sounds crazy to say, but you know, when you look at the players they have there, you know, if Familia and Diaz rebound a little bit and Betances is half of what he used to be, and Lugo and Gazelman continue to be approximately Lugo and Gazelman, you know, that could be a great bullpen. So you look at this team that has legitimate concern, that has legitimate chance of competing, and I think it's hard to argue that, well, you know, you really should limit some of their available players because there's a chance this prospect might suffer from not having organized baseball. I wish we weren't in a position where we had to make that choice because it seems like an unfair choice to make. But I understand why the Mets feel like the priority right now is the Major League roster, especially because even we're saying all of this, and as we keep harping on, there may not even be a season. So you have to kind of prepare for all these scenarios. And I would think for a young player who maybe where they live has a coaching system in place, whether it's a hitting coach or a pitching coach that they trust, I think it's more disruptive of that for that player to be moved to Brooklyn for a week and a half until an outbreak happens and then have to go back. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for consistency in these circumstances. And so maybe the best thing for that player is to, you know, have a well-monitored system at home, but that one that isn't necessarily going to be impacted by whether a season happens or not.
Yeah.
There's no good answer for this.
No. No, there's not.
No one would have ever thought an entrenched community like Hollywood could let someone come in and completely disrupt the content.
I'm Ronnie Mola.
And I'm Peter Kafka.
And we are the hosts of the new season of Land of the Giants, The Netflix Effect. We're exploring all things Netflix by talking to the people who started the company.
We'll get into their bruising battle with Blockbuster.
That was 20 times larger than us, which is not a good place to be. Okay, so in many ways, why I feel like so randomly lucky to have survived.
We'll look at the mistake that could have ended the company.
In hindsight, it was incredibly tone deaf and it blew up in our faces as it should have.
And we'll talk about how Netflix took over our screens and how they plan to win the war for our attention.
Land of the Giants, The Netflix Effect. From Recode and the Vox Media Podcast Network.
First episode drops June 23rd. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Should we talk about some of the players that the Mets have signed this week?
Sure.
There's a lot of them, folks.
There were.
All right, let's see. So, the Mets have signed... I think it was Monday this all started, correct?
Yeah, I think everybody except for one player. I think it was everyone on Monday and then Jared Hughes on Tuesday.
Yes. So in the bullpen, they signed Jared Hughes and Hunter Strickland. And then they signed Gordon Beckham, Melky Cabrera. Also, they re-signed Erasmo Ramirez, who was there on a minor league deal. They re-signed him. They also re-signed Ryan Cordell. And they signed Melky Cabrera and Gordon Beckham to contracts. Do any of these names excite you?
Well, Hughes was very good the season before last. And last year, he wasn't terrible.
Correct.
And last year's bullpen wasn't terrible would be an upgrade.
Right.
So some of these names are guys who... I honestly, like Cordell and Ramirez are guys that I didn't even realize technically weren't Mets. Since
yeah, supposedly they were released over the weekend, but I don't remember reading that.
Okay. But so, yeah, no, I just hadn't realized that. I know there was a roster freeze and, you know, whatever. And that may have happened in a normal 2020 season. But yeah, I was like, oh, okay, they re-signed a guy who I thought was still on the team. All right. Cool. You know, looking at the transaction log now, I see that. But Jared Hughes is somebody who, if they signed over the winter, I would have probably been like, oh, okay, they signed Betances and Hughes. That's good because the bullpen was a train wreck last year, and they brought in two new guys. Hunter Strickland, I'm a little more on, mainly because he's done a lot of stupid things on and off the field, like holding a grudge against Bryce Harper for years and throwing at him, breaking his pitching hand, punching a wall or a locker or whatever. At a different point, you know, a hot-headed guy who he's not going to be anybody's favorite player.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, that's it on the pitching side. And then Melky Cabrera... I just don't see, having discussed all the options that they have at DH, I don't see where the playing time comes for him. But if everybody, you know, has, if people are injured or get the virus and there's a need in 2 months, sure, Melky Cabrera could be awesome or he could be awful. As a DH, but yeah, I guess of the group, and this is on brand for me, Hughes is the one who intrigues me the most. You know, a potentially useful relief pitcher.
Sure.
Yeah, and I have no feelings about Ryan Cordell, Gordon Beckham, even Erasmo Ramirez, you know. Yeah, but what about you? Anybody jump out as a good or a bad idea?
Well, I do want to say that we had a conversation in our Amazing Avenue Slack with a number of our people on Monday that a solid like third of our staff was convinced Melky Cabrera was already a Met at some point, because it just seems like such a move that the like 2015 through 2019 Mets would have done at some point. And I know there was talk about it for a while, so we all were convinced that he had like a 10-game spell as a Met, which obviously did not happen. So, right. But that tells you how exciting that move is, that we all thought it already happened. So that's not a good indicator of that move. You know, I think that Gordon Beckham is a pretty much, I mean, he's a warm body for shortstop in an emergency. Is I think the only way you can look at that player with any sort of, real eye towards what his role could be on this team. I don't think there's any scenario where Gordon Beckham's getting serious playing time, barring a major injury, and hopefully the Mets would not. He still will not be the first choice in that scenario, I would hope. Hughes and Strickland, and Ramirez for that matter, relief pitching is volatile enough that I think for a low risk high reward potentially signing like this, I have no problem with the team doing moves like this. To me, these are the types of things that I loved Sandy Alderson as a person and philosophically, but I felt like Alderson never did these types of moves. Alderson never signed a bunch of people who maybe were low cost options, but could do something potentially positive on the field. There was just never this depth under Alderson, and so bring in Chasen Shreve, bring in Erasmo Ramirez, bring in Eduardo Nunez. Doesn't cost the team much, and if there's anything left there, you wring it out. You grab it, and so I guess Hughes is the guy for me. But really, I mean, insert relief pitcher here. If one of those guys winds up having a decent season, that's a very good thing, and I should be very happy with that. The only player of these mentioned that I have any real thoughts about is Jarrett Parker, who was not released over the weekend, but was still named to the 60 player pool. When I was down at Port St. Lucie the day before you got there, Parker's had a game. In spring training, you often see these journeyman guys just have themselves a game, and that's what Parker had when I was there. And he just seemed to be a guy who, maybe had a role. I should have looked this up. I believe he's left-handed, maybe. And so, having another left-handed bat off the bench is not the end of the world. It's a good thing for a team to have. So, I don't know. These are the definitions of unsexy moves, it's a parade of has-beens to a certain degree. And that's, at this point, with this team and the financial situation and all that, I'm not really mad at it. It just makes me mad when there are other better players out there that wouldn't have cost that much more, that instead of going after, two or three of these relief pitchers, they couldn't pool their resources for somebody who maybe have more of an impact.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Parker is left-handed.
Okay, thank you.
Look that up. But, and there's also this, this thought just crossing my mind. Imagine you're playing for a New York City baseball team for the first time in 2020. And granted, New York City, New York State, the tri-state area, the Northeast in general, all have a much better handle on things in this pandemic right now than the rest of the country.
Yes.
But still, like, imagine, I'm going to go play for, a team in New York City, whether it's the Mets or the Yankees, and you're coming in now where, just everything about being here is not normal. And, you're going to go, find somewhere to live and probably try to make that be somewhere close to MCU Park in Coney Island, mm-hmm. and go practice baseball in a minor league park in New York City without doing any other New York City things, that's got to be a little weird. I had forgotten about Chasen Shreve being on the roster. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting point.
Can I say one thing I happened to see while you were just talking?
Yeah.
While talking about the extra innings before, more than 70% of extra inning games played during the 2018-19 season ended in just a single inning in the minors.
Okay.
So it looks like it does actually. And it says in the 2 years prior, it was 45% of games ended in one inning.
Okay. Well, that's good context.
Yeah.
I'm still against it.
So am I. Absolutely. 100%. I just wanted to bring that up. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No. If we don't occasionally inform on the podcast, that's not a good thing.
That's true.
Hold on. I had a roster thought and now I'm forgetting it. Jared Parker.
Playing in New York
spring
City.
Training. Yeah. Right. Spring training. So I was only down there for 2 days, myself. But, you know, you were there for four. But I got down for the third and fourth days. And my big spring training takeaway, and, you know, over the years of going down, and it's been most years for the last seven or eight, a year here and there that I didn't, but most years getting down there, you know, I've been fortunate to see certain things, like Noah Syndergaard clearly being ready. Just before his major league debut in 2015, right?
Yeah.
I think. It's wild that, like, Syndergaard and Conforto debuted in the same year and then Mets went to the World Series that year.
yeah.
But, yeah, you know, I've gotten to be down there for some things that were exciting, you know, seeing that prospect. And I had a bit of that feeling, granted, in 2 days of spring training. Can't make any huge conclusions off of it, but Andrés Giménez had been somebody who I knew was ranked well on the prospect lists on our site, somebody who had been considered pretty widely to be a significant prospect in baseball, you know, by the national outlets that do these rankings. And for whatever reason, you know, he hit a home run, in one of the two games that we saw him play in, and then in the other game, there was a ground ball that just felt completely like a single up the middle. Not even like on the edge of like, oh, maybe he can make a good play. Just like, all right, that's a single. And I don't know how he closed the distance on getting there and turning that into an out, and making it look pretty smooth in the process. But he caught my eye. Now, you know, does that hold up the home run? Maybe, you know, maybe that's a fluke thing, maybe not, but it was just, I'm not ready to displace Ahmed Rosario, who had a good year last year, especially considering how strongly he finished the year over the course of the second half. But yeah, I don't know. I had a little bit of that vibe from Giménez of like, oh, okay, that's why, you know, that guy might be ready soon. That I understand why he had done things. And in years past, it's not like he had ever done anything that I was like, oh man, he sucks. It's just one of the things when you go down to spring training, when spring training is in Florida, is guys stand out sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not that translates to success in their minor league season or future success in major league games, it's an open question, but you know, you go down there and you just look for things. There's so much baseball in a spring training complex going on at the same time. And I don't take any of it for granted. You know, thoroughly enjoyable to watch all of it happening, but in the context of that, you know, everything's relative to like, oh my God, I'm not in winter in New York and I'm literally surrounded by baseball. Things can be routine and mundane. And Occasionally they're not. Occasionally somebody does something that stands out. In hindsight, when Matt Harvey got shelled on one of the backfields by St. Louis Cardinals minor leaguers, that was a portent of things to come. But at the time, that trip I took with my dad and my cousin, who's a big Mets fan, lives on Long Island, came down with us that year. And I think it's fair to say is a bit more pessimistic about the Mets than I am, and was just like, oh man, like, just what is going on? You know, did we really just see Matt Harvey get rocked by, you know, a bunch of guys who are in like the mid to lower minors in the Cardinals system? And at the time I'm like, you know, it's spring training, whatever. And 2 months later, essentially we established that his career as we knew it was over. So yeah, anyway, not to end it on that dark note, I think Andrés Giménez is the real deal. And I thought that about Rosario in his years down in spring training. And I know he has not become a superstar, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, unfortunately, this is not going to be a great season for evaluating young talent. Evaluating talent of any kind, really.
Right.
Because it's such a small sample size. But especially, like, if Giménez continued to have a killer spring, that would have been a real storyline in May and June. Watching how he's doing in AAA and seeing if it is going to be, you know, if he's going to be knocking on the door, you know, for Rosario later in the summer, you know. And we're just not going to have those conversations this year. And, yeah, it's a bummer for that reason. But a couple of other quick things I wanted to talk about in terms of, like, rule changes and things like that. Did you hear about the wet rag rule?
Yeah.
So pitchers can carry a small wet rag in their back pocket. It'll be used for moisture in the place of pitchers licking their fingers.
Mike Pelfrey would not be able to play baseball in this season.
No, he would not. it's weird, but, you know, whatever. Apparently, there is a no-tolerance policy for bench-clearing brawls.
Yeah.
Which seems like something that maybe was always there. Like, was there ever really tolerance for it?
I mean, I guess some of the suspensions have been light over the years, but, you know, pretty much guaranteed that several players would be suspended if it happens. But I don't know what that actually means in terms of, you know... hopefully everybody can kind of have a perspective here that we're all lucky. You know, in the most basic sense, we're all lucky to be here, whether we're at the park or at home or whatever, you know. But those who are directly involved in playing the games, we're lucky that we are playing them. You know, it sucks that ownership had to take such a hardline stance on not wanting to pay players for longer. And that's the primary reason why the season is 60 games instead of 70 or 80 or something.
Right.
But in that sort of just base level thing, everybody who's on the field is not sick, not in the hospital. Hopefully somehow it can be controlled that it doesn't get to that case. But, like, if nobody throws at anybody to start, nobody's going to throw at anybody in retaliation. And I would say the best zero-tolerance rule would be if a pitcher throws at a guy who, like, pimped a home run off of him earlier in the game or earlier in a series, like, don't let that pitcher pitch again in this shortened season. That would be actual zero tolerance of saying, you know, we know the culture in the sport is if a guy gets hit on purpose, there's probably going to be retaliation. So let's, like, truly cut that off and just say, if there's an obvious instance that you know, maybe it wouldn't be, all right, you're suspended for the rest of this season, but something that's real in a 60-game season, like a 20-game suspension,
right?
You know, where it's like, okay, your team is going to feel this. You are going to feel this. It's just not acceptable. And, you know, even if you want to be optimistic and say, hey, maybe by the winter or next spring, there's a vaccine, or we really have the virus under control in a way that we don't right now. And we're going to go back to being a little more relaxed with things like banning bench clearing brawls. Just hold on. Take it from Hunter Strickland. Hold on to that grudge. Bottle that anger up. And like, throw the guy next year. That's all. Like, and I'm not advocating throwing it, guys. But if you're gonna do it, let's just hold on. Don't do it now. Like, now is not safe because you are putting yourself and other players at risk by doing that to a greater extent than you normally would. You know, bottle it up. I'd be in favor of like letting guys have actual fights 2 years down the road if it meant they didn't do anything like that this year.
That's fair. Yeah. Let's see. Was there anything else I wanted to really mention? Oh, I wanted to mention the Nashville plan. So this is something I have only seen written up a couple of places. I am getting this from an MLB.com article that I saw Monday by Mark Feinsand. And essentially, the Nashville Sound would host 40 to 70 unsigned free agents in Nashville, and they would have twice weekly games for, I guess, just for the pleasure of the major league clubs who may need another player. That, you know, without, you know, again, without the minor leagues, there are going to be some teams that are going to be really decimated for a player. You know, if your team does not have a quality left fielder, that's a bad example, a quality shortstop in the minors, and your shortstop goes down for the season, you know, I could understand the team needing to find another free agent. So to have these players playing in Nashville sort of available, I think it's a fine thing to do. Do you have any real objection to that?
No. Yeah, no real objection given, you know, everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I don't have a more expansive answer than that, but yeah, no, it sounds relatively fine.
Sounds fine to me too. Yeah. So I think that's just about it, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think we've kind of covered all the big changes to what you would see on the field. I would say, I guess the only thing we didn't really talk about is its own thing. It's just going to be weird watching players express their personality without making contact. But I do think it's possible. Socially distanced secret handshakes, you know, that kind of thing. I think you can do that stuff. And, I mean, even with the stadium that has, whether it's a full crowd or a sparse crowd, you hear some things on microphones. We're going to hear how players really feel this year. And that could be fun.
Yeah, I wonder how they're going to handle mound visits. Are they going to, like, pump noise into the stadium?
Yeah, that's a good question. They should. They should just blare, you know, something.
I'm trying to think of what the like ideal music for that would be.
Yeah. I mean, I guess part of the question is, like, what actually gets said in a mound visit? Is it ever really that secret? Or is it more just a, you know, 15 to 25 second attempt to calm somebody down?
Right.
But there are definitely mound visits where there's some strategy talked about, especially if it's a catcher, you know, runners on base, what pitch are they going to throw? Oh, I'll throw in one other thing in terms of I'm feeling very disciplinarian here about baseball all of a sudden. If anybody's like stealing signs or any of that shit in this season, ban them for life. Like, enough. Like, we know what the Astros have done. We know the Red Sox situation. I don't know if we have details about the Yankees situation yet, other than that there was a letter. But, you know, if you cannot just try to play honest baseball this year, get out. Come on.
I agree with that. So I guess my last question for you before we get into our music picks is, obviously it'll be different because of the lack of fans. It'll be different because of the shortened season. Do you think that the game of baseball will look different inning to inning this year in terms of on-field play than it has in the past?
Not really. I would think for the first couple of weeks you might have a little sloppier defense, you know, just the lack of sharpness that comes from the combination of a long layoff and a shortened time to prepare for it. But these guys are still the best of the best. So I don't think it's going to be like, oh man, this is really crappy baseball. And I have not like intently watched KBO baseball or CPBL or NPB came back, right? I think.
Mm-hmm.
Recently. So I have not tuned into too much of it live, but seeing those players, and granted they've had shorter layoffs from playing their games than American players in the United States will have had. It's not been like, oh man, you know, this is horrendous. I think the product on the field, I think the most interesting thing will be a year, 2 years, 3 years from now. Hopefully things are back to normal. But things like pitching prospects usually have their workload ramped up over the course of years.
Right.
What happens in this year where there's zero? My guess is that, you know, you're not going to reset. But if you were of the mind that gradually building up a workload over the course of each season was a good idea, how do you handle that? And what do those guys look like? Teams that have their best prospects in most of their best prospects in lower levels of the minors, like the Mets, might be at a disadvantage when you go through this winter into next season and say, okay, guys who maybe would have at least gotten to double A, which is a significant step in the minor league ladder, they haven't had that opportunity yet. So where do you go from there? You know?
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to be an awful quality of play at any point, but if your best prospects were already close, I think you have a significant advantage over the next few years. Than if they weren't.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that overall, I mean, there are so many question marks with this season that I think the only thing I feel confident about is if players are healthy and if we get to watch baseball, it'll probably be less polished than it was in years past, but I don't think any of us are going to care. And you're going to see some development take longer of younger players, and you're going to see probably the more rapid decline of some aging players. But ultimately, if it can be done safely, I think we're all just going to be so thrilled to have baseball that we're not going to notice those things.
Yeah. Yep.
But we'll see. Anyway, Chris, what is your music pick for this week?
So based on our pre-recording conversation this evening, memory sparked a band called the Icarus Line that I had been into. I think they still, their most recent release wasn't that long ago, but the whole sound and concept of the band changed significantly to the point that I honestly don't know why they kept the name the same. But they made a record in 2001 called Mono. That was the first music of theirs that I heard. And then they put out a record in 2004 called Penance Soiree. that is really good. I'm actually itching to listen to it. Maybe not tonight, but definitely this week after talking about it on this. They had some personnel changes. You know, looking at it, looking at their Wikipedia, it's like past members is like 15 people. So I don't even know what the band is now or what it was when it ended, if it ended. But they made a hell of a record. I hate to fall back on like a Stooges influence, but there's definitely one there. While at the same time, it doesn't sound like any specific Stooges songs. But yeah, listen to it. It was an album that made sense as an album. You know, you really want to listen to it from start to finish. It's not like a concept record or anything, but it just all fit together so well. And it was this unique sound. You know, the guitarist went on to play in Nine Inch Nails for a while when he left the band a long time ago. And I think that was around the time that the rest of what they did had kind of changed course. But yeah, this record was pretty great. The only reason I'm even seeing this, I don't look at Pitchfork scores on anything, but it happens to be listed in their Wikipedia. Even Pitchfork gave it a 7.8, which is like basically a 10 by Pitchfork standards.
Right.
So yeah, check it out. It was unique, and I don't hold it against anybody. Any band can be a band for however long they want to be. But it bummed me out a little bit that coming off that they didn't make anything else that I was into.
Yeah, it's always interesting when bands take those sharp turns, why they continue to be called the same band, because obviously their fans of the older stuff are not necessarily going to follow to the new stuff. But, you know, these things happen, unfortunately. All right, well, my pick is a new record, new-ish record. I guess it came out last week, 2 weeks ago. It is by a band called Corikey. It's spelled Corikey. This is the band that is made up of Ian MacKay of Fugazi, Joe Lally of Fugazi, and Amy Farina of The Evens, which was Ian MacKay's post-Fugazi band. And also she happens to be MacKay's partner slash well, I'm not sure if they're married, but they've been together for quite some time. The Evens saw MacKay play a baritone guitar, which sort of changed their sound. He is back to playing his classic SG on these recordings, but it is very similar to The Evens, so it's nowhere near as loud or as shouted as Fugazi music. But it's still really intense. I love Joe Lally as a bass player, and I think his bass is the star of this album. If you removed his bass, it would be an Evens record, which is still good, but his bass really adds a lot to the sound. His bass kind of weaves in and out of MacKay's guitar, and MacKay and Farina have a really nice vocal interplay together. And as I said, it's their first record together. It's 11 songs. It's really, really good. It's one of the few records I've heard this year that, or not even this year, I've heard in the last couple of years. Sometimes you hear about a band that features members from a band you used to love, and you're not sure how it's going to go. This sounds like the best version of these three people playing together. And that's really fun for me. I like The Evens. I love Fugazi. So this is very, very cool. It is out on Discord Records, which is MacKay's label. And yeah, I highly recommend it. Self-titled release by Corikey.
Awesome. Yeah, no, it's it is always cool to see that kind of thing. So I don't think I've seen either of those two play or any of those three in that band. And I've not listened to that record yet, but damn, I need to. But Brendan Canty from Fugazi, the drummer, yeah. was part and was scheduled to be part again this year. Wayne Kramer from the MC5 had, you know, put together this like awesome lineup around him. Kim Dale from Soundgarden, Canty on drums, Doug Pinnick from King's X on bass. And then I don't know if everybody knew the band Zen Gorilla, but the dude kind of had a look like Rob Tyner of the MC5. So, you know, he had put this band around him and called it MC50 to do like a 50th anniversary yep. celebration mm-hmm. of Kick Out the Jams. So as far as I know, over the years, I've only seen one Fugazi member live in any capacity, but that was just a fun night. It was just, you know, we're going to play these songs. You know, you all know them, we all know them. But the band was awesome. And to take, you know, that level of talent and really have it be a cover band of everyone who had been influenced by the MC5, playing with, you know, the longest, the most prominent member over the course of decades now, you know.
Yeah.
That was pretty awesome.
I also want to shout out Canty and Joe Lally, both of Fugazi, have another band called The Mesthetics. Have you heard this band yet?
Oh, yeah. I listened just a little bit. And a friend who I made, who has since moved out of this area, but he spotted me at a Shellac show, and he recognized me from the Metro North platform that we happened to
wow.
be on together. But he had pointed out a Mesthetic show, I think it was last summer. Right? That record came out last year.
They've released two records, one each of the last 2 years, yeah.
Okay, so I think they were playing a show, and for whatever reason, unfortunately, I wasn't able to join them to go check that out. But yeah, so that's my familiarity there. But there's a lot of Fugazi-related music I need to listen to, is what I'm taking out of this.
It's very jazzy and also kind of jammy, but also super punk. It's very weird, but it's good.
Yeah.
It's definitely good. And then last thing I want to say, just because you mentioned Soundgarden, there is a rumor going around that the three members of Soundgarden are recording a new record under the name, hang on, I just had it here. Nude Dragons, which is a terrible band name.
It is. But the three of them making music, anybody on vocals?
They've set up an Instagram account, which is at Nude Dragons, I suppose. I was double checking that. And so they at Nude Period Dragons. And it's just the three of them sharing selfies the three of them took. But on the official Soundgarden Instagram, there's a picture of Chris Cornell, and Chris Cornell's son is wearing a new Dragons shirt in that picture. So that's how, I guess, that's how folks found this. Whether it's legit or not, I'm not sure, but I would like to see those three guys make music together, so that'll be fun.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Well, thanks for listening. I would guess maybe we'll be back next week. Maybe we'll take a week off to sort of see how the news cycle is going. But, you know, we've been doing a lot of stuff at Amazing Avenue to sort of prep for the season. We're now knee-deep into our season previews. And, you know, we had a great article about the DH the other day. So go to AmazingAvenue.com for all your Mets-related news and needs. And, you know, we shall return when there is news to talk about. But until then, go to Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Amazing Avenue to find out about us. Check out the rest of the Amazing Avenue family of podcasts, the soon-to-be-returning Unformettable, From Complex to Queens, and A Pod of Their Own. You can follow Chris on Twitter, at Chris McShane. You can follow me on Twitter, at Brian Needs a Nap. You can email us, aaaudiopodcast@gmail.com. And stay safe, everybody. And until next time, let's go Mets.